Group meeting, Sunday, 17th January, 1982.
This is the question which was asked me last December, after the Sunday meeting. Should one wait till one has sorted oneself out spiritually before joining in doing good works? I think this is a really important question, and it's a very good question. Obviously, the questioner is sensitive and perceptive, means business, and is serious-minded. Of course, this is a question which raises up quite a large number of other questions. So I've just jotted down a few points which we might consider together today. Because we know only too well how many people rush into doing what are called good works, joining this society, that society, undertaking this, undertaking that, and so forth. Sincerely believing, of course, we must grant that, take that for granted, sincerely believing that they are doing a really good work and so forth. But there are lots of illusions attached to this very sincere desire to do good. So it becomes important, I think, first of all to inquire, why do we want to do good works? And perhaps the first question which should be considered, but which the good worker probably does not consider at all or insufficiently. And that is, do I want to do this, join others in this good work? Because the question does say joining, doing good works. That means being involved in a group. The question which one doesn't look into is this desire to join in such and such a good work due to a pleasure drive in me? Now, if it is due to a pleasure drive, then it does not mean that by doing this, by joining in this good work, I will find pleasure. I may find considerable displeasure if and when I find that others are not in harmony with me, they don't like what I want to contribute towards it, or I haven't got the ability, or something like that. So this pleasure drive element has to be thought about very, very carefully. And of course, that is tied up with the question of personal interest. Now, personal interest is a very subtle business altogether. Personal interest almost always involves self-interest. I am interested in this because I identify myself with this particular kind of work. Now, if I identify myself with the work, what sort of person am I who is being identified by myself with the work? I'm a person perhaps with some good qualities, some abilities, but also full of imperfections. And if the element of personal self-interest gets associated with the work, then it will unquestionably do a good deal to spoil the work. This perhaps may be seen in the way in which the sort of principal workers in the group are at loggerheads with each other often. They don't agree with each other as to what should be done, what ought to be done. They don't see clearly enough all that is involved in the work and so forth. And they see it from a personal point of view, my point of view. Well, my point of view is always spoiled by my defects, my deficiencies. That is a fact. And we have to face that fact. That if I become engaged in any particular job as such, not only my abilities and good qualities, but my disabilities and my bad qualities will all play their part in this. Now, this is not to suggest, therefore, that one should just step aside from doing any good works or joining in any good works at all. Not at all. Because day-to-day life demands that one should associate oneself with others in some sort of good work which oneself and they can do together. But it is very important for the serious person, the person who means good business, profitable in the right sense of the word profitable, it is important for him to see what is faulty within himself. If I can see what is faulty within myself, I have a good chance of eliminating, up to a point at least, those defects in me which would spoil the good work. I have, during my lifetime, been interested in various societies, of course, mostly concerned with religious, psychological, philosophical groups and so forth. And I've seen in all those groups, without exception, how the innate flaws in the nature of each person defeated the definitely idealistic aims of the group. Definitely defeated them, you see. They all saw it from their point of view, and each person's point of view is probably covers a smaller arc than the eyes of a horse who has the blinkers on him. So we have to look into that question. And then, of course, there is a more powerful influence at play. The satisfaction of one's power lust. We all have a power lust, especially the good people amongst us in the world. We all have a power lust. We are, in a subtle way, if not in an obvious way, conscious of being good and knowing what is good for others and all the rest of it. And we are going to step in and do this, that and the other, and lo and behold, heaven and earth will take root. This question of power lust is extremely subtle. It is and extremely powerful. It is so tied up with our isolative self-consciousness. We have our own image involved in the statement, I am I. And everybody is perfectly certain that he is he, or she is she. Perfectly true, only insofar as the person as a particular existential being is concerned, and no more. And each person's self-consciousness is of such a nature that he or she says to himself, I am I, and not that fellow or this person or anything or anybody else, which denies the actual fact of the entire universe, namely, that we are completely interrelated and interacting. All the world influences me, and I influence all the world, all the time, without stopping, whether I'm conscious of it or not. It is impossible to prevent that. That is the way the universe is constructed. You see? So now, this I am I, this isolative I am I, is the source of this power lust. It is also the source of the lust for possessions, because possessions we are conditioned to believe and accept the statement that possessions mean security. They mean nothing of the sort. In a sense, they are security, because you have the wherewithal, at least, for food, warmth, shelter, and so on. All right, that is so. But when we extend that into the realm of the psychological and the spiritual, we are hopelessly wrong. There is absolutely no security through possessions where our interrelationship with humanity, with the whole world, is concerned. Possessions do nothing in that sphere. They are only a burden, actually. Look at the people who are extremely wealthy. Rarely do you find somebody who is healthy, who is happy, who is secure in himself. It's very interesting to notice that. You know, in ancient India, nowadays unfortunately all that is gone, what was laid down for the merchant group was the acquisition of wealth. But it was laid down with this very special instruction in addition. Your wealth is intended to satisfy all your needs for existence: food, warmth, shelter. Keep your family well and happy, and give them the opportunities for education and this, that, and the other. And of course, where illness and the healing of illness was concerned. All right. But remember, you are only a trustee of that wealth. That wealth is for the benefit of the whole village, of the whole town in which you live, of the country in which you live. That was definitely laid down as the spiritual and moral duty of the Vaishya class, the Vaishya caste. And it is a fact of history that, starting with kings themselves, who had vast granaries in which food was stored and so forth, those granaries were always thrown open in times of famine to the entire population. So now you see, their wealth, there perhaps one had a sensible outlook on wealth as such. It was not intended just for personal enjoyment and exaltation and so forth, you see. It was meant for service of the whole. And of course, on the Vaishya caste was laid down specially the duty not to be attached to what you possess. How many millionaires do we have who are free from attachment to their wealth? One, two, three in the whole world today? So now, let us pass on from this business of power gratification and dominating the social group. There again you get an extraordinary instance of power lust at work. One joins a society, and before a few days or weeks have passed, that person's dominating the whole group. I remember very well one what one may call a high grade social group, which was interested in psychology as and psychotherapy for healing purposes. And there came along at one of the meetings a newcomer, and he sat quietly, listened, looked round. I saw him looking round at everybody and occasionally shaking his head and so forth. And at the end, when, of course, everybody spoke freely in this place. The meetings were held in Gower Street. When he asked permission to say a few words, and he said, I like the smell of this group. By which I mean, he said, the sort of idealism they have and the work they want to do, and I would very much like to be associated with the group. So of course he willingly signed on the dotted line, and I think hardly 3 or 4 meetings had passed by when this man was laying down the law for everybody present, practically. Fortunately, we had a really capable Romanian, no, a Serb. This was in pre-war days, pre-Second World War. I can't talk of pre-First World War days. We had a very good, capable Serbian who was really a very brilliant psychologist, very capable man. And he put it right by putting this man in his place. And before a few months had gone by, we noticed that his chair was always empty. Now you see how power lust works. And that's only one instance. Then, of course, there is a very important point associated with why do we want to do good works. If one wants to do so, because one cannot help doing so, because of compassion for the suffering of others. Real compassion for suffering in the world. And we all know how much suffering there is in the world. Or do we really know it? We can see only a little bit of it. But the suffering in the world today is really something tremendous altogether. If in our ordinary state, we were to suddenly become aware of the total world suffering, we would probably die as a result of knowing that. It would kill us. It would break our hearts altogether. Now, if one has compassion for suffering, for those in suffering, well, of course, that is an excellent reason for joining in doing good works. But then another point arises. What is the particular kind of good work that I'm thinking of joining in? What is it? Often it is a little bit trivial. I won't suggest instances and examples because that is a matter of opinion. I look at human life from the standpoint of mankind in its present subhuman stage growing towards full humanity, which means the life which is the life of the saints, to put it in simple terms, and an intelligent life, and a life where truth and all the great spiritual values function freely and unobstructedly by the individual. But then that is my particular viewpoint. It's a bias, if you like. Bias, not in the wrong meaning, but in the sense of a natural inclination towards, one's natural bent, as we call it, you see. So we have to consider what is the good work which we want to be associated with. And once we have, when we have considered that, another question arises: have we real understanding and ability to do this good work? If we haven't, then we are likely to be people who are the bandwagon joiners. They get on the bandwagon. It's a paying job, and it is. And you have not only something of an income out of it, but you also get a lot of kudos for being associated with this, that, or the other good job. The best job is one which is done quietly, silently, without other people knowing it. That is the best good that one can do. Because there, the self element is completely out. Where there is no selfness, then all humanity is included in your outlook and in your activities and benefited by you. That is very important. So we must understand what the good work is, and we must be reasonably certain. We can't be absolutely certain. We must be reasonably certain that we have the ability to participate here and make a really worthwhile contribution. Otherwise, you know how many cranky people there are rushing about doing what they call good work. And they make themselves an awful nuisance, especially if they are supposed to be high up in society. You know, Lady so-and-so, or the Duke of so-and-so, and all the rest of it. They come and pester you and make you join their society and extract 10, 100, 1,000 pounds out of you and so forth. And the more they can extract out of you, the higher are you in the hierarchy of the workers for good. I mean, all this humbug and nonsense goes on all the time, all over the world. The hypocrisy of it and so forth. And of course, each person feels that he'd like to open the window a little more because he wants to throw his chest out now, having done the good work. Now, that also implies that one has to look into a very deep question. What is the good? What is the good? Take this problem which we all face in the advanced countries particularly, because we have the money, the means, the technique, the equipment to do this job. Prolongation of life. Consider the misery of so many geriatrics whose life is unnecessarily prolonged. They themselves don't want to live any longer. Their faculties are gone, their health also perhaps is beyond repair, and so forth. But oh no, prolonging life is arbitrarily laid down as an absolute good. Well, that's nonsensical altogether. Now, in that connection, think of what happens when certain cures are effected. You know, in the First World War, Hitler was blinded by chlorine. You know, they used chlorine as one of the poisoned gases. And a skillful German doctor cured him. What happened afterwards? What happened? It's true that, of course, it is definitely true that he probably was the most powerful factor to precipitate the Second World War. Now, what happened to him himself in consequence? But although he and his nation lost the war as such, technically speaking, the whole world has lost terribly. We are all plunged in a ghastly situation today, and we can't stop it. Look at the economic situation. Look at the political mess everywhere. Socially and sociologically, perhaps, we have been able to make a certain amount of progress, as we call it. But note carefully, all this progress is in terms of what is good for me, what I like. Making the separate individual the central point in the whole thing is one of the most powerful influences for producing disharmony in the world, starting with disharmony in the family and extending to one's own society, one's nation, and the whole world as such. And Hitler's losing the war, the hot war, has only perpetuated a worse war, because it is far more subtle. So you see, curing Hitler's blindness brought about that. Now, does that imply, therefore, one mustn't heal, because that's your vocation as a doctor, that's your divine vocation, to heal the ill, the suffering person. But if you confine it to the body alone, your work is fragmentary. It is not a whole work. The real healing of a sick person is the healing of the whole person, which implies the psychological healing and the healing of his outlook on life, his spiritual vision. The whole making of his spiritual vision. If he can have even a spark of light, which can make him understand, make him sense that there is a transcendent reality, which is a unitary whole, and it is the business of every human being to become reintegrated into that unitary whole. This is the triumph, not merely of the spirit or the intellect or anything, but the triumph of the whole being, the whole person. Body, feelings, thoughts, emotions, everything, and the spirit also. What am I going to do? You see? So, if the work which I think of joining in is something which quite lacks this, and it is a work which tends to promote fragmentariness, then you are doing something which promotes conflict, separation, and so forth in the world. So all these things have to be taken into account. Then there are long-term situations which have to be considered. Look at the sad and unnecessary slaughter of animals which goes on all over the world. and has gone on since the days of Adam and Eve. You see? Unnecessary slaughter. Of course, if you lived in Greenland or in the distant places of Tibet or Mongolia or some such place, you have no option but to slay the animal to live yourself, you see. All right, one may understand that. If anybody asked me what would I do if I was in Mongolia or the wilds of Siberia or something in the north, how would I feed myself? I said, I just come back to the south. And if I couldn't come back, well, all right, I'd rather perish than innocent, unoffending animals be slain in order to feed this carcass here. Far rather. Makes no difference to Mother Earth. She's managed 5,000 million years without me quite well. And she'll probably manage better when I am out. That is to say, not so much out as right inside Mother Earth again. You see, our vision is so short, it's so clouded, it's so unworthy. We lack vision, we lack light inside ourselves. And to satisfy our own ego and our own belief in our goodness and so forth, our egoism and our vanity needs feeding. So we join in this good work, rush into that good work, and so on, in order to sort of feel that I have proved myself. I don't need to prove myself. Transcendence made me. The entire universe conspired to bring this finite, temporal, mortal, existential being into existence. All of it conspired to bring me into existence. So I don't need to prove myself. I think one of the most wonderful things Shakespeare ever did comes in Midsummer Night's Dream, when Puck says, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." I speak from experience. I have discovered what a fool I have been, and still am. That's the sort of thing that conduces to make one very depressed, to discover one's own folly and shortcomings. It conduces to that. But remember this, once you really see it, the depression disappears. Because you feel depressed because you do not want to accept the fact. If you can really see the fact and say, that's what it actually is, all right, it is so, finished. That's what it is in this vast universe, this immeasurable universe as far as we are concerned. And then the depression disappears, and a strange thing happens. There is an alchemy going on in the psyche, and that folly begins to undergo change. It is not rooted out, it is not destroyed, because no energy can be destroyed. It is there, eternal. But the expression of that energy in its unhappy form of folly gets transformed into some sort of wisdom, and wisdom grows that way. So this unnecessary slaughter for food, and worse still, for sport, killing for sport. And we call ourselves civilized and advanced people, and we go out to the to the people who are of belong to lesser breeds in order to civilize them and take true religion to them. When the first commandment is thou shalt not kill. Extraordinary. Another point is this question of ecology and living ecologically. How we have disemboweled our Mother Earth. Why? We say for progress. More marvelous methods of transport, more iron, more copper, more this, more coal, more this, more that, all for building cities, houses, and so on and so on. And is humanity really the happier for it? Maybe a little bit more comfortable for those who can afford. And those who can't afford, rise up and fight against those who can afford. Don't they? Look at the world situation. Everywhere there is this terrible conflict, misery all along the line. And life is so simple and can be so wonderful just by itself. If one sort of remains wide awake and truly mindful, then one awakes fully in time. It takes a little time. Perhaps it takes a long time, but one awakes fully to the root poison of our existential life, selfness. And when one really sees the selfness operating every day in this, that and the other way throughout our daily life, then it disappears when you see it. It's extraordinary how that happens. So, perhaps it is wiser to be quiet and watchful instead of rushing into good works. By no means desist from joining in good works. I'm not saying give up all the good works you may be engaged in. No. But consider these points. Consider how one can really do good in the so-called good work. You see? And if one looks, one remains mindful, then you'll be surprised to discover how many opportunities during a single day and every day of one's life, how many opportunities arise for doing good in that immediate situation. Where eternity is concerned, there is only immediacy. No time, no succession. It happens immediately. And eternity is realized by us who are temporal beings, who are temporal creatures, as and when we see truly. This seeing truly is the thing that works the magic. It converts hell into heaven. Straight away, immediately. There is no time or succession involved in it. Because after all our heavenly experience and all our hellish experience is a matter of the mind at work. What's happening in the psyche? You see, how is the psyche responding to the circumstance, the immediate circumstance, all the time, from split second to split second. So now, one doesn't have to wait until one has sorted oneself out spiritually completely, because you can go on for all your days. And after all, it is granted only to the few to reach the heights. It's not for everybody. I was born, I have lived my life, I shall die, and I shall have fulfilled, I trust, to some extent, the particular place in the world for which the universe brought me into it, brought me into manifestation. All right? Sufficient unto the day is that. Be content. If one is greedy enough to want to become a Buddha, a Christ, a demigod or a big god or whatever it is, one is just foolish. Have no ambitions about it. We are all made to think this way. This is our conditioning from infancy onwards, to think in terms of living the good life in order to have one's reserved seat in the mansion upstairs. That is the fact. Look at it carefully. Why do we undertake good? Why do we go to religion? Why do we turn to religion and so forth? I'm dissatisfied with this, found that distasteful and all the rest of it. Let me try out religion. Why? In order that I may be satisfied. That is the curse of the whole thing. Make the I am I just a big zero. Make it a no thing, a nothing. And in that nothing, the totality is contained. That's what you'll wake up to. Out goes ambition, envy, jealousy, hatred, violence, fear. Everything will go out straight away. And then whatever you do, whatever you touch, will be a good work and one worthwhile doing.